the water. Israel has also sent troops into a buffer zone east of the occupied Golan Heights, but the regime denies advancing towards Damascus, insisting that its forces were stationed within the zone. More than 300 Israeli strikes have been reported since the fall of Assad government in Syria. Lebanese journalist Sondos Al-Assad earlier joined us with her take on the Israeli aggression against Syria and the regime's occupation of a buffer zone in the Golan Heights.
What we have been seeing during the last 3 days is a blatant aggression against the Syrian sovereignty, starting from occupying new parts of the Golan Heights and the continuous aggression on the military capabilities of the army of the Syrian army and on the research centers and all the capabilities that makes Syria a sovereign country and a capable country. And no one of those who have taken control of Syria now has condemned this aggression or condemned this new occupation of Syrian lands, threatens the unity of the Syrian lands and threatens the sovereignty of the Syrian lands. And this is related actually to Netanyahu's declaration of what he calls the new Middle East and his ambitions to expand all over the West Asia region. So this is quite concerning, and especially after this relentless aggression against the Syrian army and the attempt to weaken Syria further.
The general command of militants in Syria has appointed Mohammed al-Bashir to lead the transitional government until March 2025. Bashir, who was appointed prime minister on Monday, made the announcement in a televised speech. Bashir had led the militant so-called Salvation Government in northwest Syria and held the role of its development minister. Meanwhile, a meeting has been held between former Syrian cabinet ministers and proposed ministers of the new government to discuss the transition of power. The development comes after the militant group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HDS, seized the capital Damascus in a lightning offensive following President Bashar al-Assad's fall from power. Condemnations are pouring in from across the world over the Israeli violation of Syria's sovereignty. The regime's military has seized territory and stepped up strikes across the Arab country.
We are continuing to see Israeli movements and bombardments into Syrian territory. This needs to stop. This is extremely important.
The UN Special Envoy for Syria has called the Israeli attacks a deeply troubling development, describing the current situation in the Arab country as highly fluid. Peterson emphasized that tensions remain unresolved and urged other countries to avoid actions that could impede the ongoing transformation. Iran has criticized Western nations for their support of the Israeli regime and silence on such blatant violations. Meanwhile, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Qatar, Cuba and Venezuela have all condemned Israel's land grab near the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. The Qatari Foreign Ministry has labeled the incursion as a dangerous escalation. As violence in Syria subsides, many Syrian refugees in Lebanon are considering going back home. However, their country's future is hanging in the balance. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh has spoken with some of them at the Syria-Lebanon border.
Lebanon and Syria have historically been intertwined, and any development inside Syria directly impacts Lebanon. Today, we can see thousands of Syrians returning to Syria, but at the same time, we have hundreds of families that have flocked to the Lebanese border to seek refuge, or for fear of being persecuted, or even because of fear of the unknown.
There's no police, no army, no security. It's not safe. It needs time to settle down.
I wish I can return to Syria, to my country and my town.
We came from Dera. From Dera to Beirut, no one stopped us. There were no checkpoints or anything.
Because of the total absence of the Syrian authorities on the Syrian side of the border, it is now up to the Lebanese authorities to really regulate the border, to keep things under control, and to only allow the entry of Syrians who meet the necessary criteria for entry. Maryam Saleh from the Lebanese-Syrian border.
It's day 431 of the US-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Unrelenting air and artillery attacks pound more areas across the blockaded territory. In one of the strikes, at least three people were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed a group of Palestinians in the Araba area near Rafah, southern Gaza. A similar strike targeted another group of Palestinian civilians near Rafah, killing at least two and injuring several others. The Israeli artillery also shelled a number of areas across the coastal sliver, leaving several fatalities, including women and children. The Israeli aggression, which began in October last year, has so far claimed the lives of nearly 44,800 people and injured more than 106,000 others. Lack of food, water, medical supplies, and other basic necessities is also taking its toll on the Gaza population. Our Gaza correspondent Ahmad al-Najjar has further details regarding the latest Israeli attacks across Gaza. Let's take a listen.
The latest here is that Israeli occupation is massacring more Palestinians in more attacks that spared no place in the besieged Gaza Strip, starting here in the southern Gaza, particularly in Rafah City, in the northern parts of Rafah City, where the occupation targeted a group of people within the Maraj neighborhood that is in the northern western outskirts of Rafah City. And all three Palestinians were killed and transported here to Nasser hospitals. And earlier to that, also within Az-Zuhur neighborhood in the north and eastern parts of Rafah City, another group of Palestinians was targeted. And this attack, at least two Palestinians were killed, along to several injured who were moved to the European hospital in the eastern Khan Yunis. When it comes to the northern parts of the Gaza Strip, where people are still being massacred for more than 68 days now by the ongoing Israeli operations and ground incursions that has been going on for more than 68 days, focusing on Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and Beit Hanun, we have been getting reports on dozens of families being just wiped out in total silence and in horrible massacres that took place just over the past 24 hours.
The current struggle for food and flour amid Israeli restrictions on aid delivery has proved deadly in Gaza. Israel is employing systematic starvation as a means of putting more pressure on the war-stricken population. Gatha Ibrahim reports from Gaza.
With the year-long ban and blocking of aid entering the region, the situation has escalated to alarming levels. In the wake of the ban, five individuals, including two children and three women, tragically lost their lives in desperate jostling over bread at a bakery in Deir el-Balah. One of them is 11-year-old Zaina Juha, who woke up at dawn to get her family a pack of bread, but she was killed at noon. She was crushed to death.
Zainab is gone now. She was a child, but she felt responsible for her father and family. She used to make beads bracelets and sell them to pay for a pack of bread. She woke up very enthusiastic about her birthday. It was our habit to make her a cake every birthday, but when she asked, I told her I can't because we don't have flour. So she insisted and went to sell the beads bracelets she had made maid and headed to the bakery queue. After a while, her brother called, telling us she is not breathing. She was crushed in the jostle. Zeyna went to bring bread, but neither she nor the bread returned.
This is an everyday scene. People swarm every bakery in central Gaza. As Israel continues restricting the humanitarian aid in Gaza, the recent tragedy at local bakeries has shed light on the harsh reality people living in the strip are facing. The UN estimates that nearly most of the population of 2.2 million face the highest category of famine risk, a catastrophic level close to imminent starvation and death. Of the global population at risk of this level of famine, 80% are in Gaza.
I don't have any source of income. The flour crisis is escalating as I have a family of six to feed. I had to stand at the bakery queue for long hours, and sometimes I come back home empty-handed.
On October the 9th, Israeli officials clearly declared that they want to starve the population by imposing a total siege on the Strip. This, against the backdrop of 17-year Israeli blockade, has left half of the population in Gaza food insecure and 80% of them relying on humanitarian aid. It is not new for Israel to weaponize aid delivery and systematic starvation. However, it should be alarming to the world that more Palestinians are still dying for the sake of a handful of flour. Ghada Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah.
The Israelis have held a demonstration outside a court in Tel Aviv where the long-standing corruption trial of Prime Minister Netanyahu has resumed. Dozens of protesters, including families of Israeli captives, gathered outside the court, accusing Netanyahu of mishandling the war in Gaza and failing to secure the captives' release. Demonstrators called him a dictator and demanded an immediate end to the war and a safe return of the captives. Netanyahu is facing multiple charges of fraud, breach of trust and bribery, as well as providing regulatory benefits to media in exchange for favorable coverage. He is the first sitting Israeli prime minister to face criminal charges. Netanyahu denies all allegations, claiming they are part of a political witch hunt orchestrated by adversaries in the media and the judiciary. Protests against Netanyahu have intensified in recent months, with many blaming him for the ongoing war in Gaza and the captivity of Israeli citizens. Israel continues violating the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon, with the regime launching more strikes on the country's south. The Lebanese army says that one soldier was killed and four others sustained injuries due to an Israeli strike near a military checkpoint in South Lebanon. Israeli forces also targeted civilian residences, resulting in the death of three individuals, including one woman. Meanwhile, four Israeli soldiers were killed and several others injured after entering a minefield along the border with the occupied Palestinian territories. According to Israeli media, the rescue operations lasted for 12 hours. Although the truce agreement reached on November the 27th has significantly decreased hostilities, it has not halted Israeli violations in the region. Director for the Center of Muslim Affairs, Jahangir Mohammed, joined us earlier from the UK city of Manchester to discuss the Israeli violations of ceasefire with Lebanon. Let's take a listen.
It's inevitable that Israel doesn't observe any agreements or ceasefire, and their interpretation of this is you cease and we fire, and the coalition that is supposed to be monitoring this, well, they'll just agree to anything that Israel does. So it's inevitable that ceasefire won't last. Israel is doing everything to achieve its regional goals, whether that's Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, any other country. And the US has, United States has given them a blank check to do whatever they want and to finish the job, as they say, even before President Trump comes to power. And they're doing that. So I think Israel is a state that exists outside international law. It's a rogue state. International law doesn't apply to Israel, and that's because the superpower of the day, the United States, gives it total authority to do as it wills.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news. Thank you, Steve Das, for more.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Donald Trump has said he wants to pardon his supporters involved in the attack on the U.S. Capitol. He also said some members of the House committee that investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol should go to jail, and that he won't request a special prosecutor to investigate outgoing President Joe Biden. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. President-elect Donald Trump said he's looking to pardon his supporters involved in the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021, as soon as his first day in office, saying those incarcerated are living in hell. Donald Trump made the comments his most sweeping since he won the election in an interview with NBC News' Meet the Press moderator Kirsten Welker. He also said he won't seek to turn the Justice Department on his political foes and warned that some members of the House committee that investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol should go to jail. On his first day in office, Donald Trump said he would bring legal relief to the 6th of January rioters, who he said have been put through a very nasty system. Trump said, "I'm going to be acting very quickly on my first day." He said, "They've been in there for years, and they're in a filthy, disgusting place that shouldn't even be allowed to be open." Trump said there may be some exceptions to his pardons if somebody was radical and crazy, and pointed to some debunked claims that anti-Trump elements and law enforcement operatives infiltrated the crowd. At least 1,572 defendants have been charged and more than 1,251 have been convicted or pleaded guilty in the attack. Of those, at least 645 defendants have been sentenced to incarceration, ranging from a few days to 22 years in federal lockup. About 250 people are in custody, most of them serving sentences after having been convicted by a court of law. A handful are being held in pretrial custody at the order of a federal judge. Donald Trump didn't rule out pardoning people who had pleaded guilty even when Kirsten Welker asked him about those who had admitted assaulting police officers. Trump replied, because they had no choice. Asked about the more than 900 other people who had pleaded guilty in connection to the attack but weren't accused of assaulting police officers, Trump suggested that they had been pressured unfairly into taking guilty pleas. Donald Trump said, I know the system. The system is a very corrupt system. They say to a guy, you're going to go to jail for 2 years or for 30 years, and these guys are looking, their whole lives have been destroyed. For 2 years, they've been destroyed, but the system is a very nasty system. Charges have ranged from unlawful parading to seditious conspiracy in the sprawling 6th of January 2021 investigation, which included rioters captured on video committing assaults on police officers and those whom admitted under oath that they'd done so. January 6 defendants in custody include Proud Boys and Oath Keepers convicted of seditious conspiracy. A January 6 defendant recently convicted of plotting to kill the FBI special agents who investigated him. Another charged with firing gunshots into the air during the attack, and another arrested outside former President Barack Obama's home after Donald Trump posted a screenshot that included Obama's home address. Trump said he wouldn't direct Pam Bondi, whom he has said he will nominate for Attorney General, to investigate Special Counsel Jack Smith, who brought two separate federal cases against Donald Trump that were ultimately dropped after the election. Trump called Jack Smith deranged and said he thinks he's very corrupt. Ultimately, he said he'd leave those decisions to Pam Bondi, and he said he wouldn't direct her to prosecute Smith. I want her to do whatever she wants to do, Trump said. I'm not going to instruct her to do it. Trump claimed that members of the House January 6th committee had lied and destroyed a whole year and a half's worth of testimony. He singled out Republican Liz Cheney of Wyoming, a vocal Trump critic who left Congress, and Democrat Benny Thompson of Mississippi, who chaired the committee, saying that they had destroyed the evidence collected in their investigation and that those people committed a major crime. Liz Cheney said in a statement released on Sunday, 8th of December, that Donald Trump lied about the January 6th Select Committee when he said committee members should go to jail. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. In his first sit-down television news interview since winning a second presidency in November's election, Donald Trump renewed promises to pardon his supporters involved in the attack on the U.S. Capitol in early 2021. He also doubled down on promises of mass deportations and tariffs in the conversation with NBC's Meet the Press host, Kirsten Welker. Trump said in the interview, I'm going to be acting very quickly on my first day. He claimed convicted Capitol attackers had been put through a very nasty system. Trump said, I know the system. Trump was convicted in May by New York State prosecutors of criminality falsifying business records to conceal hush money payments to a film actress, Stormy Daniels. But he added, the system is a very corrupt system. Trump said there may be some exceptions to his pardons over an attack on the Capitol that was meant to keep him in the Oval Office after losing the 2020 presidential election to Joe Biden, and which was linked to multiple deaths, including the suicides of traumatized law enforcement officers. He referenced previously debunked claims of anti-Trump law enforcement infiltrating his supporters' ranks and agitating the attacks on 6th of January 2021. When Trump was asked about Capitol attackers who assaulted police officers, he said they had no choice. He also claimed individuals were pressured into accepting guilty pleas. Their whole lives have been destroyed, Trump added. He criticized the outgoing president's recent pardon of his son, Hunter Biden, on convictions of lying on gun ownership application forms, as well as tax evasion charges. Donald Trump denied he would direct his second administration's appointees to arrest elected officials involved in the investigation on the attack on the U.S. Capitol, which led to federal criminal charges against him that have been dismissed. But he made it a point to tell Kirsten Welker, honestly, they should go to jail. More than 1,250 people have been convicted or pleaded guilty in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. At least 645 people have been sentenced to serve some time in prison, ranging from a few days to 22 years. During his sentencing on Friday, 6th of December, Philip Sean Grillo of New York City, one of the Capitol attackers, tauntingly told the federal judge presiding over his case, "Donald Trump's gonna pardon me anyway." Grillo received a one-year prison sentence and was ordered to be taken into custody immediately. Another of the convicted 6th of January attackers, Edward Kelly of Tennessee, was found guilty at trial in November of conspiracy to murder federal employees. Jurors determined he had developed a list of officials he wanted to kill for investigating him in connection with the Capitol attack. In other parts of Sunday's interview, Donald Trump reaffirmed his plans to enact tariffs on imports from some of U.S.'s biggest trading partners. He said he could not guarantee U.S. families would not pay more as a result of his plan.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani. He's going to explain the book Islamic Beliefs, Reclaiming the Narrative. This book contains the lectures delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei prior to the Islamic Revolution, and it focuses on revisiting the sacred scripture to better understanding the true purpose of faith, consequently changing the way we see life and the world around us.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'd like to continue our discussion. So brothers and sisters, if you remember, our discussion is actually about Allah's promises for the mu'mineen. So I want to mention, this is now the first thing, before we get into God's promises. The question is, how do God's promises keep us from despairing? That's the question. Right now, I want to talk a little bit about despair and how God teaches us you never despair, no matter what the situation is. And then, inshallah, we'll get to God's promises and we'll see how many of those promises we can cover. So the first one, brothers and sisters, where I'm going to share this verse of the Quran, but before I share the verse of the Quran, I'd like to give a little bit of context. The context is this: not despairing no matter what the situation is. Nabi Ibrahim, God's going to share these words of wisdom on the tongue of Nabi Ibrahim in a discussion between him and the Malaika. Nabi Ibrahim and his wife Sarah, Sayyida Sarah, they didn't have any children. Some ulama tell us, at the time when these verses were revealed, she's 90 and Nabi Ibrahim is 110. So she's 90. More than that, what we learn from the ayat of the Quran is that even when Sayyida Sarah was young, she was barren. So medically, she could not have children. Now she's 90. And her husband is no spring chicken. He is 110. How does God talk about not despairing? So for context, the Malaika give them good news that you are going to be having some children. They said, say it, ayat of the Quran, she was so shocked that she slapped her face and shrieked, ayat of the Quran, because it was a 90-year-old, I would be a grandmother, and now you're telling me I'm going to have my first child? What happened, though? Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to talk about this concept. We're going to look at now at the words of Nabi Ibrahim. So, brothers and sisters, if you could help me and turn to Surah number 15. So if we can turn to, let's see if I quoted it properly. The conversation between Nabi Ibrahim and the Malaika. Surah 15 and verse number 56. So Nabi Ibrahim, because obviously his wife was very surprised. This old, the angels want to know, well, are you, because there's different ways they relate this in the ayat of the Quran. Are you surprised at what God can do? In some of the ayat of the Quran. Have you despaired of Allah's mercy? Despair now. So what does he say? Qala. So Nabi Ibrahim speaking. He said, وَمَنْ يَقْنَتُ who and who would despair مِنْ رَحْمَةِ رَبِّهِ from the rahmah, from the mercy of his Lord, إِلَّا الضَّالُونَ except for those who are lost. Only a lost person, someone who's utterly lost, could know God in his goodness and despair, even in a situation which was this improbable. Another story from the ayat of the Quran, again about this concept of never despairing. So in this next story, our prophet Nabi Yaqub is talking to his sons. So remember his sons had really messed up. They had kidnapped his son, who was going to be the next prophet. They kidnapped him. They had lied. His son was sold into slavery. God knows how many years. Remember the story, we learned that they were actually only 18 days apart. So the family of Nabi Ibrahim, they were only 18 days, but Allah willed that, no, you're not going to know where Yusuf is. How many years later after this that finally the boys go over? They're older now. I shouldn't call them boys. The young men, or now maybe older men, go over and they go to Egypt. They finally meet the Aziz. Benjamin is taken with them on the second trip. Benjamin gets stuck over there. We all know the story. And then at that stage, they come back without Benjamin. And instead of Nabi Yaqub despairing, so these boys are lost. These boys, there's no saving them. They kidnap the child of a prophet. Lie. Don't do Tawbah. What does Nabi Yaqub say? So Nabi Yaqub is about to send his boys back over to find Nabi Yusuf. And he doesn't despair, despite the years, and he doesn't let them despair. So let's see if you can find Surah number 12 and verse number 87. Again, the concept of despair. Why is it the believer never despairs? Let's see if I've quoted this verse correctly. Do you guys have Ya Baniya? Any brothers? Y'all have it? Any of the sisters found it? Okay. Oh my sons, idhabu, go. Fatahassasu min Yusuf wa akhihi. You search for Yusuf and his brother. And then the line about despair. وَلَا تَيْأَسُوا مِنْ رَوْحِ اللَّهِ. And do not despair of the mercy of Allah. Why never despair of the mercy of Allah? إِنَّهُ لَا يَيْأَسُوا مِنْ رَوْحِ اللَّهِ. No one despairs of the mercy of Allah. إِلَّا الْقَوْمُ الْكَافِرُونَ. Except for disbelieving people. Kufr is mentioned in the ayat of the Quran. The believer never despairs. Not only a lost person or someone who didn't even believe in God. Otherwise, if you know God as he introduces himself in the Quran, there is never a reason for despair. Now, part of this, brothers and sisters, is because we believe all things are in his hands. Even ourselves. All things are in God's hands. And knowing that everything is in his hands, so we don't rely on ourselves to the extent that we think that it's all on us. We are going to push with everything we have, but we know it's all him. As an example, when we say everything is in God's hands, Imam Khomeini, once God, he said, the story from Imam Khomeini, he said, Allah took my memory from me. God, Imam Khomeini says, Allah took my memory from me. He says, for 15 whole minutes, I couldn't remember my name was Ruhullah Khomeini. God can do that. Like, it's always in God's hands. But God has power over all things, and now the promises of God.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir. Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Climate disasters are wreaking havoc across the planet, with dwindling hope of the current climate pledges, curtailing global temperature rises as the US and other fossil fuel nations continue to expand fossil fuel production. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. climate justice campaigners have condemned the United States after the world's largest historic greenhouse gas emitter argued against countries being legally obliged to combat the climate crisis. The U.S. intervention came on Wednesday, 4th of December, as part of the historic climate hearing at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, at The Hague, Netherlands, where island nations and other climate-vulnerable countries are calling for wealthy, polluting nations most responsible for climate breakdown to be held legally responsible. Climate disasters are wreaking havoc across the planet, with dwindling hope of the current climate pledges curtailing global temperature rises as the United States and other fossil fuel producing nations continue to expand their fossil fuel production. Yet according to the United States, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the 2015 Paris Climate Accord and other existing non-binding treaties should be preserved and are the best way forward. Margaret Taylor, legal advisor at the U.S. State Department, told the judges at the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, on Wednesday, 4th of December, "The current United Nations climate change regime embodies the clearest, most specific, and the most current expression of states' consent to be bound by international law in respect to climate change." Margaret Taylor added, "Any other legal obligations relating to climate change mitigation identified by the court should be interpreted consistently with the obligations states have under this treaty regime." Climate justice activists responded with fury. Vishal Prashad, director of Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change, said, "Once again, we witness a disheartening attempt by the United States to evade its responsibilities as one of the world's largest CO2 polluters." Vishad Prashad added, "The U.S. is content with its business-as-usual approach and has taken every possible measure to shirk its historical responsibilities, disregard human rights, and reject climate justice." Ashfaq Khalfan, Oxfam America's climate justice director, said, "It is absurd for the Biden administration to argue before the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, that countries do not have clear legal obligations to reduce carbon pollution, especially as it prepares to turn over the executive office to a proven climate denier like President-elect Donald Trump, whose policies are likely to deeply harm U.S. climate action." Australia, China, and Saudi Arabia, major fossil fuel economies, are among the world's worst greenhouse gas emitters, but they also argued against legal accountability that developing nations are pushing for. After years of campaigning by vulnerable nations and the global climate justice movement, the United Nations asked the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, to provide an advisory opinion on what obligations states have to tackle climate change and what the legal consequences could be if they fail to do so. More than 100 countries and organizations are testifying over the course of 2 weeks, and many hope the hearings will elevate science to the forefront, ensuring international law reflects the realities of climate breakdown and the urgent need for transformative action. The International Court of Justice advisory opinion are non-binding but carry significant legal and political weight, and this will likely be referred to as an authoritative document in future climate legislation and during international climate negotiations. Those most vulnerable to climate change, predominantly Pacific Island nations such as Vanuatu, are pushing for their financial support and compensation for irreversible loss and damage from the states most responsible as they face an existential threat from rising sea levels, floods, drought, and other climate disasters. On Wednesday, 4th of December, Vanuatu's Special Envoy for Climate Change, Ralph Regenvanu, said his country was disappointed at the United States and others. Regenvanu said these nations, some of the world's largest greenhouse gas emitters, have pointed to existing treaties and commitments that have regrettably failed to motivate substantial reductions in carbon emissions. These treaties are essential, but they cannot be a veil for inaction or a substitute for legal accountability. Taylor also appeared to dismiss the idea that the International Court of Justice should propose in its opinion that historic emitters be held responsible for past pollution. She said, an advisory proceeding is not the means to litigate whether individual states or group of states have violated obligations pertaining to climate change in the past or bear responsibility for reparations, nor would it be appropriate to do so. The International Court of Justice is one of the three international courts tasked with producing an advisory opinion on the climate crisis, alongside the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. The International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea found earlier this year that greenhouse gases are pollutants which states have a legal responsibility to control that goes beyond the United Nations framework for climate change. The Inter-American Court held hearings in Barbados and Brazil this year and is expected to be next to publish its opinion. The International Court of Justice, the ICJ ruling, would likely take many months. The website of Carbon Brief has also covered the same story and tells us more. Representatives of vulnerable states have told judges at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, a handful of countries should be held legally responsible for the ongoing impacts of climate change. During a hearing at the Peace Palace in The Hague, which began on Monday, 2nd of December, Ralph Regenvanu, Vanuatu's Special Envoy for Climate Change and Environment, said responsibility for the climate crisis lay squarely with a handful of readily identifiable states that had produced the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions but stood to lose the least from the impact. The court heard how Pacific island nations such as Vanuatu were bearing the brunt of rising sea levels and increasingly frequent and severe disasters. Ralph Regenvanu said, "We find ourselves on the front lines of a crisis we did not create." The hearing is the culmination of years of campaigning by a group of Pacific Island law students and diplomacy spearheaded by Vanuatu. In March of last year, the United Nations General Assembly unanimously approved a resolution calling on the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, to provide an advisory opinion on what obligations states have to tackle climate change and what the legal consequences could be if they fail to do so. In the coming days, the court will hear statements from 98 countries, including wealthy developed countries, with the greatest historical responsibility for the climate emergency, such as the United Kingdom and the United States of America, and countries that have contributed very little to global greenhouse gas emissions but stand to bear the brunt of their impact. These countries include Bangladesh and Sudan, as well as Pacific Island nations such as Vanuatu. The United States and Australia, two of the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitters, made statements too, even though neither fully recognizes the court's authority. Ralph Reganvanu told the court that states continue to emit vast amounts of greenhouse gases in spite of increasingly dire warnings from scientists, noting that carbon dioxide emissions had increased by more than 50% since 1990. The court will publish written statements submitted to it as part of the advisory opinion process, a number of which will include personal testimonies from people affected or severely threatened by climate change. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of this speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a thousand of veterans and active members in the sacred defense and the resistance field. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 25, 2024.
It is wajib, religiously obligatory, to have female doctors. So it is important for women to pursue medical training until there is an adequate number of female physicians. Teaching is also another example of wajib kifayi for women. It is obligatory to have an adequate number of women teachers. Though sometimes this obligation may clash with managing a household, having children, or the resting periods and breaks that a housewife needs. Similarly, a woman's work hours may interfere with her ability to attend to the work at home. If there is a conflict in these cases, it is the duty of the country's officials to think about this. The number of these professionals should increase to the point where if a teacher is required to go to school 5 days a week, for instance, she should be able to go only 4 days without there being any lacks. Another teacher should be readily available to substitute for her. It should be the same for medical practitioners. Therefore, in professions, managerial positions, fundamental jobs, and jobs that are wajib-e kifai for women, the presence of an adequate number of women is obligatory. There should be no limitations. If a conflict arises between a woman's work at home and her professional duties, this should be managed in a way that ensures both areas are taken care of. Although, in my opinion, these two do not conflict with each other. I know women are very successful. I know women who have successfully balanced demanding social roles, whether it be academic or non-academic jobs, while also raising several children, and they manage to do both very well. Hence, these two tasks do not conflict with each other.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are two important points according to Islam's view. Women are free to be active in all fields, such as being active in society and politics, etc. However, this should take place while remembering two important points which Islam is sensitive about. The first is the issue of the family, which I mentioned. The second is the potential dangers associated with sexual attraction. The danger of sexual attraction. Islam is sensitive about this. Islam forbids us from preparing the environment and atmosphere in such a way that it will be a place for going astray due to sexual attraction.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.